Good evening, everyone. This is Pam Stack, your host, and welcome to Authors on the Air. Tonight, we are continuing with Nasty Women January Female Crime Fiction Writers, and my special guest is dark, suspense, gothic, wonderful mystery writer Laura Benedict. You are going to have so much fun talking to her. We'll be right back. Everyone, it's been just a great way to kick off January talking to female crime fiction writers. We had so much fun with Terry Shames. I've had so much fun with everyone so far, and tonight I have Laura Benedict with me, whose newest book called The Abandoned Heart is actually rolls in right at 400 pages. We had a good laugh about that before the show. This is the third and final book in her Bliss House novel. If you've not read it, go right now. I'll wait. Hurry up. Go to Amazon. I want you to go and buy the book. Go on right now. Okay. So now that you have Laura's book, we're going to bring her on here. I don't know if you know that she's the author of six novels of what she calls dark suspense. I call it gothic, dark gothic mystery, because it is. She's an amazing author. She shows up everywhere. Everybody knows her. I'm just honored she decided to come and talk to me. Without further ado, let me introduce you to Laura Benedict. Hi, Laura. Welcome to Authors on the Air.
Hi, Pam. I'm so glad to be here, and I feel so honored to be talking to the big boss herself. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, please. Oh, please. I'm just like,
I'm psyched.
On, please.
I'm psyched.
Good. I'm glad you're psyched. I am too. Before we get going, everybody write down this number, because I want you to call in and say hi to Laura. I might just gift a book somewhere along the line here. The number is 347-633-9609. I'm opening the phone lines now, so that anyone who wants to speak to Laura can give us a ring, wish her a happy new year, ask about her books. It's great. So she also has been a guest on NPR, which most people who know me know that's my favorite radio station. And so between Diane Rehm and Terry Gross, I aspire to be them. Unfortunately, I'm not NPR. I'm more like Funny Farm, but... But Laura, you're here, and so you've elevated me already. Thank you.
Oh, hey,
did you have
I'm thrilled.
Thanks. Did you have a good holiday, first of all?
You know, I had a great holiday because I planned ahead, and I got everything done so that I could spend Christmas with my daughter who was home for Christmas, and we stayed in our what I call our second jammies. You know, like you get up and you've got your jammies on.
Yep.
Well, then you have to put on comfy clothes. And I think after we opened presents and had Christmas breakfast, we watched like three horror movies. that was how we spent Christmas, kind of napping and watching horror movies. And it was a blast. It was a blast.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. Oh, that, you know, that's so important. The holidays have a tendency to be so stressful, but on the day of the holiday, when you want to enjoy yourself, you're busy running around. Sounds like you planned it perfectly. Good for you.
Well, you know, Thanksgiving is my big runaround day, because I love to do the whole big meal thing. And, you know, it's all about the food. So Christmas Day gets to be all about the relaxing.
Well, that's good. Do you like to cook?
I love to cook. I love to cook. I've been, you know, I've been cooking since I was, you know, 17, 18. And I haven't poisoned anyone yet.
There you go.
Nice
to you, girlfriend.
I didn't hear about it if I did. But, no, I love to bake. I taught myself how to bake bread. And I love to bake.
Oh.
So Oh,
wow.
I love carbs, though. I can't eat them anymore, but, you know, I love to bake.
But you can bake for others. Before our family kind of went in all separate directions and my folks died, we always celebrated a huge, huge feast. And I love to cook and bake all the desserts and everything. I mean, days and days and days ahead of time. And it was always so much fun. But since now we're in different cities around the country, I'm really grateful for peace and quiet. Isn't that crazy? I get to read books. I get to snuggle with my cats. And so there's a lot to be said for putting that all behind you. You know, kids are grown, have their own life.
Yeah,
yes.
It's balance. You know,
it truly
sort of long-term balance, and that's good.
Next year, if you invite me, I'll be there, and I'll bake.
Okay.
I'll bring.
Ooh.
You know,
ooh, I like
let
that.
Me know. Yeah. Of course. Let's talk about the Bliss House, because talked about before the show started, I am traditionally not a lover of historicals, and I'm not a lover of horror or ghostly things, because I'm a wuss. So
right.
I wanted to read your book to be prepared for our interview today.
You are very brave, by the way. That's very brave.
I am. I'm giving myself a pat on the back right now. I know you can't see it, but trust me, it's a very warm and lovely pat on the back. The thing is, your book is, first of all, very visually appealing. Your publicist sent me a beautiful hardcover copy. It's a very warm feeling book because of the colors. It's yellows and rust and brown. It feels very autumny and welcoming. The woman on the front of the book, your main character on the front, is dressed in period dress. And I'm thinking, oh, the abandoned heart. It's going to be so romantic. Well, you know, what do I know? I started reading, and your prose is what drew me in. It was truly a beautiful literary story that, yes, had a mystery. It was ghostly. It was suspenseful. It was scary in some parts, but oh, so satisfying at the end of the book. Thank you.
Oh, good. I'm so glad to hear that. That is really so important to me. And I worry a little bit when people look at that cover and they don't know my work, because, you know, I was at a book fair or book fest in Cincinnati, and
uh-huh.
You know, people would come over and they'd be like, oh, is this, you know, romantic? And I'm like, that's a certain kind of romance, but probably not what you want to have with somebody.
Right.
You know, but it is a beautiful cover, and Pegasus has done a great job with the entire trilogy, and started out, you know, with Bliss House, the first novel, with putting the house on the cover, and they got it the first time out, and I was thrilled about that.
So let's
talk about the
trilogy itself. Let's go back and talk, first of all, about Bliss House, because it's a beautiful house, and the colors kind of meld, you know, the first and the last book kind of are together. You've received incredible ratings and reviews from everyone. I mean, Booklist is mad for you on this. They love it. They just love, the Michelle Lieber who reviewed it had this to say: Benedict combines the supernatural with the all-too-real peopling the haunted house milieu with psychopaths and adding elements of guilt and betrayal for an engrossing and suspenseful read. So I love that. I loved what PW said. They call it, it's a bloodstained history of madness and murder. It's so good, and it's so visual, all of these lovely reviews that you got. Tell me about how Bliss House came into your head.
Well, you know, I had always wanted to write a haunted house story. I love haunted house stories. I love gothic tales. You know, my very first gothic was Jane Eyre, and of course you had, you know, Thornfield Manor, and the Castle of Oronto, which is the very first gothic that was written in like the 16th century, I think. I'm going to say 16th, 17th. And I love a haunted house. I love modern haunted houses. I love historic haunted houses. And I also love Virginia. And we moved, I know. We moved here to Illinois from Virginia. And the thing about Virginia is it's, for America, it's old, right? I mean,
yes,
if you have history in the United States, you're either up, way up east, you know, or Massachusetts, or you're at Virginia.
Right.
And
right.
We lived there for 8 years, and before that in West Virginia for 6 years, where my husband's family is from. And I just love it. I just felt like home there. And so I wanted to have a haunted house, and I thought, what better place than Virginia? Because in Virginia, everything is about the history. You know, I mean, if you're a Virginian, you know your Virginia history. You know, you spend the entire fourth grade tracing across the state learning all about the battlefield.
Right, Colonial Williamsburg and William and Mary College and all of those places.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Sure.
And so when I put the house in sort of southwest central Virginia, I could just really see it there. And I could see the town of Oldgate there. And I really do write from place. And so once I had the house established, you know, in that place, the people just kind of showed up and told their stories. And the thing about a house that is that old, you know, you think about living in an old house. I mean, there's a lot of living going on. There's a lot of dying going on. And I've always thought that a house takes on the personalities of the people in it. You know,
and the memories
of people. The happenings, the memories, it's all there. So what has happened with Bliss House, well, I mean, you find out in The Abandoned Heart exactly why the house is haunted.
Right, right.
But, you know, reading the first one, you know it's a little more complicated than that.
Exactly.
That the house is very active and it gets very involved. It manipulates the people who live inside it. That's a really long answer.
But it's a great answer because there are so many layers and so many textures to your writing that my sense of what was happening with this story is that the house had absorbed the essence of the people who had always lived there. So there were layers of people and layers, and so all that was in my mind. That was in my memory. That was in my mind when I was reading that, you know, it the house itself had retained a personality from each of its prior occupants. Does that sound like I missed it, or did I get it partially?
Absolutely. I mean the house. Of course, this lives in my head. I think about, you know, the way it's all worked out. The house kind of takes what can be sometimes the best in people, but usually it's the worst in people, and magnifies it. And, you know, pulls it out and makes it and twists it so that they become almost caricatures of themselves. And that is why the bad people in the story are really, really bad.
House almost is a character itself, wouldn't you say? Because the character is like a puppet master almost.
Right. the house
a manipulator.
is the continuing character. And, you know, I wanted so many of my friends write series. And I thought, I want to write a series. And I thought, okay, well, if I have a series, I'm going to have a character. Because that's how you carry a series, right? Well,
sure.
I didn't have a character that came to me. I had a house. So
you had place.
So I thought you had place. And so that's my version of a series. I don't see myself. I've thought about writing, you know, a character driven series, and I just don't know that I see it happening, because, you know, I get a house. We get what we get.
We do, and it was brilliant. So, you know, there's no denying that this is a great series and a great character, even though your character is the house. You are definitely a storyteller. So that brings me around to a thought about your upbringing. I know that you lived in a couple different places, both in Cincinnati and then in Louisville. So you have kind of, you know, there are different places to grow up in, and you claim both of them as your home. Was there storytelling in your life as a child? Was there a lot of reading? Where did your love for books and writing come from?
That is such a great question, because there are a lot of answers there. I would say my love for books came from my mother's parents, and when my father was in the Marines, he was stationed over in Japan, and so my mom and I lived with her parents for a couple of years. And my grandparents retired early, and they basically spent the rest of their lives reading. I mean, my grandfather would go to the library, and I would often go with him when I was old enough to go along, and just come home with, they would go once a week to the library and come home with 20 books.
Right.
And they would just read.
Yes,
they
I know
read
that. I know
time.
That. How
and,
wonderful.
And so that's what I saw, you know. I mean, and you know, my mother spent time with me with my little books, you know, but I wanted the big books. I wanted to, you know, get the 1930 set of encyclopedias and read the stories, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
I wanted my own books. And so, but as far as the storytelling goes, you know, it was very sort of middle class, very Catholic Cincinnati, you know, family.
Sure.
And
sure.
Not particularly intellectual, you know. I mean, it was just a family. But the extended family would come over to our house, or mostly my grandmother's house, and the women would sit around the table after dinner and smoke and play cards and drink Pepsi and talk and tell stories and gossip and laugh. And I just, you know, I mean, I would just sit there and soak it all up. You know, they say little pitchers have big ears. I mean, I heard it all.
Absolutely. Oh, how
and
wonderful. What a marvelous thing. What about the men?
The men were generally listening to baseball. You know, they would wander off and listen to baseball, which is, and I did some
how
of that
interesting.
Too. I did
how
some
interesting.
Of that too.
You know, because generally storytellers, like generational storytellers, have oftentimes, and most often, I should say, been the man in the family. They pass the family history and the tales and the stories down from generationally from man to man. But I love the fact that the women in your family told the stories in gossip tales, which are often more interesting, I'm sure, than just hearing a straight story from something out of their past. Are your parents, or were your parents or your grandparents or maybe siblings or children, are there other creatives in your family?
You know, not really. I seem to have been the odd duck. And, you know, I mean, the thing is, they are, you know, like my sister, she took her creativity and she teaches, she gives her heart every day to autistic five-year-olds.
Oh, well, see, then she's creative, too. She has to be able to reach them.
There is nothing more creative
yes.
than that. There really
Absolutely.
Is
Absolutely.
You know,
Absolutely.
and my other sister has been in business, and she has raised three wonderful boys, and, you know, she's made a community for herself. So, you know, it's all creativity, but I am the one who said, okay, I'm going to take this story thing and do something with it, you know.
How long have you been writing stories? Let me change the question.
Okay.
How long have you been telling stories? How long have you been telling stories?
Oh, that's a really interesting distinction. I didn't really have a voice for telling stories when I was growing up. I was very quiet. I was kind of a troubled teenager, which is probably another reason I became a writer. I thought I was going to be a librarian because I love books.
Really?
I thought I would be a librarian. I didn't know that people could be writers. I didn't realize that. I didn't know that was a possibility for me. And when I went out, I worked for that great big beer company in St. Louis and mm-hmm. in a subsidiary there. And I was working, coordinating sales promotion projects. And I was buying the work of copywriters. And I found myself rewriting the copy just because I wanted to. Not because it was bad or anything.
I love this.
I was just like, I want to do this differently. And I thought, you know, I probably need to stop messing with other people's work and learn how to write. So I went back to the college I graduated from in St. Louis, and I started taking writing classes. So that was...
What a great story. I love that. I love the fact that you said I was a troubled teen, which is why I became a writer. I'm thinking you were a troubled teen, which is why you became a gothic storyteller, because I can't see you writing lighthearted comedy if you were a troubled teen. I certainly remember those years. You are not alone. I don't want you to feel like you were an oddball in any way, shape, or form. I was a troubled teen as well, although I loved being a teenager. So you decided to be a writer. How many books did you write before you were picked up by a publishing house?
I wrote, I call Isabella Moon, which is my first published novel, I call it my third first novel.
Right.
So I wrote.
I understand that.
I wrote two complete novels. The one I just said, okay, because I read Somerset Maugham's biography, and he said that when you write a novel, you should just put your first one in the drawer. And I think
right.
that is fabulous advice, because now, of course, people think they finish a novel and they put it up on Amazon.
Right.
That's not how you grow as a writer. That's how you...
Right.
You know, write something down and throw stuff out there.
Right.
You know.
I understand exactly what you're saying. I love the fact that you said it was your third first novel that got published. I think that's magnificent. So when you look back at your first book, which you said was Isabella Moon, and I'm looking at the cover right now. I'm looking at two different covers, actually. And I love them both, by the way. What has changed about your writing since Isabella Moon to The Abandoned Heart?
Oh, now I didn't think you were going to ask me hard questions.
Oh, well, I told you it was all about you. You know,
I know, but I have, let me think a moment here.
What did you think? I was going to read the press release and go by that?
No, I just had never. That's such a great question. Nobody has ever asked me that before. You have nailed it.
There you go. I've popped your cherry. Thank you.
You have. Oh my gosh. I think I have become. I've definitely become a more confident writer. But in some ways, I've become a more careful writer. And
interesting.
You know, I mean, you can't ever rewrite your. You can't ever duplicate the experience of that first novel, you know? I mean,
right.
the sort of the mental gymnastics it takes to do that.
You remember the angst, but you can't exactly duplicate the experience itself, right?
Right. No, exactly. And you know, I took so many chances with that. And that novel, Isabel and Moon, is the novel that if you go back and look at the reviews, and I really have stopped looking at reviews because they just, you know, they whipsaw me back and forth and I get upset and I get happy and I can't bear it. I have too many feels. But that book just polarizes people. They either love it or they hate it. And I kind of like that. But so I don't feel that I'm as free a writer as I used to be, and I kind of would like to get a little bit of that back, which is why the book I'm working on right now doesn't actually have any supernatural in it. It's
really?
A suspense novel. It's straight suspense, and I, you know, my mystery stories, the stories I've had in Ellery Queen and other places, I, you know, don't have any supernatural in them. And so it's sort of a, you know, it's a line that you have to decide whether to cross or not. And I'm going to stay on the other side of the line this time because I love new experiences. I want to do new things all the time.
Oh, so I'm so glad. Oh, that's wonderful. Do you ever have an urge to write, really remove yourself from that paranormal, suspenseful thing and just totally change it up? I mean, would you ever try science fiction? Would you go fantasy?
Yes.
Would you try tragic romance? Yeah, you would.
I love
that.
I love
that. Most women writers that I speak to who have started off in crime fiction or mysteries or thrillers or suspense seem to be more able to imagine themselves writing in the different genres of fiction than a lot of the men who write. Now, there are plenty of male authors who will try anything to see how it is. My good friend Russell Blake is one. He'll try all the genres to see what works for him. And I love that. And I love to read it too. It may not appeal to the masses, but it, you know, how can you know if you don't try?
Exactly. It's a growth thing too. It's a growth thing.
Sure.
And that's one reason I'm almost glad I don't, you know, write a series character, because I know a lot of writers who, you know, either their publisher says, okay, we can't do this anymore, or the writer says, I can't do this anymore. The market wants predictability. And, you know, I want to grow as a writer. I don't just read and never have just read dark fiction. You know, I mean, I adore Margaret Atwood and Joyce Carol Oates. I love Louise Penny. I have sold so many Louise Penny books to people. I'm just like,
I hear you because you're always
trying. This.
I know you're pimping them. I know.
You know,
I have seen your post on her. I know.
I adore her work. You know, I'm like right now, I'm reading Frankenstein with my son, whom I homeschool half the day. We just started Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. I'm reading The Silence, which is that's going to be the film. And I'm reading Hercule Poirot's Christmas. You know, you have to read everything. I want to write everything. Everything and write everything.
I think that's amazing. I'm so happy to hear that. You know, there are plenty of authors who have fantastic series characters, but their storytelling skills are above excellent. They're uber excellent. And so I think that's what makes it. And not without, and the people I speak, you know, I'm thinking of people like C.J. Box, who's great, John Lasqua, Jeffrey Deaver, David Baldacci. You know, they do standalones, but they also have their series characters that they go back to. And I love
well,
that.
Well,
I think I have to
mention J.T. Ellison, too.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you know
she's magnificent.
J.T.'s work.
Yes.
She is magnificent,
yes.
And she has made the leap to standalone so beautifully. I mean, she can write anything,
yes.
You know, and
yes.
love that. She continues
I like
to grow.
Being able to read all the different ones. You know, I mean, people, a lot of people who don't know, kind of do a ha-ha-ha at Nora Roberts for romance, but they also don't know that, you know, J.D. Robb thrillers are amazing, the same way as Mary
yeah.
Higgins Clark has gone from, you know, a little suspenseful novel to thrillers to romance to, and everything in between, supernatural, paranormal, whatever. You know, it doesn't diminish, I don't think, an author in any way. Unless Unless they give up. Do you know, know what I'm saying? It becomes like sloppy or lazy. And those authors tend not to be in the spotlight anymore.
I think they get bored.
I would imagine. I would imagine so. And if you're bored with it, it's time to change it up and do something else, don't you think?
Exactly.
So I need to take a little break to remind everyone that this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I always try to say it in one breath and never can. I also want to say, pick up the phones and call. I'm going to give away a copy of The Abandoned Heart by Laura Benedict. The number to call is 347-633-9609. Truly, if you love suspenseful writing, if you love a little kink of horror and a little bit of mystery and a whole ton of gothic, you're going to love this book. Laura's prose, her narrative is just sensational. You will not be disappointed. So let's give a call. Laura, I love talking about writing process because it's so different for every single writer. What is it like for you when you finally latch on to an idea and you sit down and wiggle your fingers over the keyboard, clap your hands and say, okay, here goes? What is your process like?
Well, there's a lot of terror involved, and I don't mean I don't mean the prose. I mean I face
that
page with so much fear every time. I mean it is actually the hardest thing I've ever done, and I think that's one of the biggest reasons I write. Because I love a challenge, and it is the hardest thing I have ever done. I mean, I gave birth to my two children via C-section, so I hear childbirth is hard, but
right.
So maybe childbirth would be harder, but writing is so hard for me.
Let me ask you something. It's putting down the first sentence and actually starting it. That's where most people get stuck. Firing writers continue to aspire because they can't write the first sentence. Is that true or false?
Somebody says, I don't know how to start, I say, then start in the middle. Because if you don't know where you're going, if you don't know how to start it, that means you're probably starting in the wrong place.
Very interesting.
The thing that comes to your head is what you have to go for. The thing that you are afraid of, go for it. But sometimes it's okay. I mean, just because, and I have to tell myself this all the time, just because something comes to you easily, which doesn't happen all that often for me, doesn't mean it's bad. It might actually mean that's good. And so when people are really struggling to put that first line down, I love crafting first lines. That is a huge challenge, and that's a lot of fun for me. And generally speaking, I don't start in the middle. I write that first line. Occasionally, I will find that I have started the story in the wrong place. And that happens to every writer. If you're honest about your work, sometimes you start in the wrong place. And you just have to sort of pick up stakes and move along. But yeah, going with what's there, because the story, yeah. You know, for me, the story, this is going to sound all goofy and metaphysical and dorky, I'm sure. But for me, the story exists in the universe. And my job is to be like an archaeologist and uncover the story and discover the story, not to make it up. You know, I mean, if you're working really hard to make something up, it's maybe not going to work.
You have
to discover the story that's there, because stories are so organic. Stories are like, you know, living, growing things. And if you try to make it grow one way, it may not want to go that way.
I see what you're saying. So it has to be very organic.
Yes. Yes.
So I have also heard that never worry about your first draft, because it really is just a throw up of words on the page. Is that correct?
That's not really true for me.
Okay.
I write, and I only say that because I get a lot of feedback from editors and from, you know, people I know well who are writers who read, you know, we read for each other. I am appallingly anal about my first draft. I edit
funny.
As I write. Are you making fun, or are you really surprised?
No,
really...
a lot of people do that. They write a chapter, they edit it, and then they go on to the next one. And particularly
right.
if they write a chapter a day, they find that to get back into the writing zone, it's real important to go back and read what they've already written and get into the zone, and you might as well edit it at that time. I think it's brilliant if you can
exactly.
do it like that. I know
yeah.
some people that do like 20 edits on their manuscript, and it blows me away that some people just do one. Some, you know, it averages probably 3 or 4, but others do as many as 20 edits, revisions,
yes.
and go over
mm-hmm.
it. So, you know, good for you if that's how you are with it. I think it's magnificent.
I worry. I don't want to send it to somebody and have them think there's something wrong with it. I end up being a pretty easy edit because a lot of it ends up being just, you know, copy edits. And so, you know, and it's funny because it sounds really goofy, but I sometimes wish an editor would just slap me around and make me change a bunch of stuff. So I kind of want to do that sort of, you know, throw out everything you got, you know, put everything on the page, just sort of, you know, spew it out and then see what happens. I kind of want to do that, but I don't know that I ever could.
Well, but that's, you know, that's you, that's your particular style. And that's amazing. I think that's so great because if you spend a lot of time editing or going back and forth with your editor, that can be kind of frustrating, don't you think? I mean,
yes.
It takes longer to get a book out there. I don't think that it's easy to write a book. I think it probably takes a lot of time. And I wouldn't want to have to keep – listen, this is why I don't pre-record interviews, because I
mm-hmm.
don't want to have to go through and edit them. I like the spontaneity of a live interview.
Sure.
With its flaws and all, I think it's the most fun for me. But if I wanted to be less Funny Farm and more NPR, like everybody
mm-hmm.
else, I would go in and pre-record these things and do all this editing and voiceovers and stuff. I can't. I'm not built like that. I'm kind of built like you. First draft, make it right, and then just send it out into the universe and pray. So,
well, and you know, there other, you know, I mean, and it also depends on the editor, because some editors really like to be involved in the process and they like to be involved in the story. And, you know, so I, it may be that I've just worked with editors who are, you know, sort of happy with my work and are, you know what I mean? I mean, they may have other stories that they're more interested in working with. I don't know. It's because editing is such, it's not a mystery, but there's so many different types of editors out there.
Absolutely.
God, I agree with you
100%. But, you know, you must be doing something really right, because the fact of the matter is, Laura, your books are getting rave reviews. Your skills must be improving because you're getting more reviews that are rave. And so good on you. Good on you. So I'm thrilled for you. I think that's amazing. And I'm more impressed than ever reading your book and knowing that you don't spend time after time. You edit it. You go with what your gut tells you. And don't you think that's a lot of it, too, on just about anything we do? Your intuition,
yes,
and your gut instinct has to take over? Yeah.
You have to have faith. You have to have faith.
And trust.
And trust.
Yes.
You have to trust yourself. But, each book is a new experience. And that's
yes.
the hard thing. It's like, I mean, and I know this is true for a lot of other writers, when we sit down to do that next book, it feels like we have never done it before.
Really?
Always, every time. Every writer I've ever talked to, it's not, I mean, even if they're working a series, whatever they're writing, it's like you forget what it was, you know, what the whole process was like last time, because different books demand, maybe your habits will remain the same, but they're
sure.
different creatures. They're different creations.
Right. Right,
and
right.
so it's different every time. And so, you know, the more experienced you get, and that's something, you know, when I talked about, people just like publishing their first book because they get it done and they want to go on, I just want to say, you know, honor your instincts a little bit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Get, you know, learn the craft so that when you get sort of a backlog, that you're not learning on stage, you know, that you give yourself a break.
Right, right. So it's not live in person like my show is. So when I screw up, everybody hears it.
but then we can laugh about it. That's the thing. See, I got embarrassed
and that's survived. You know, well, and that's true. And that is the nice thing about my medium versus yours. You don't want anyone to laugh at your book unless it's a comedy. So
exactly.
So what I'm hearing you say is, just because you have written 6 books or 60 books, it doesn't make it any easier to write the next one. Because you still have to have the idea. You still have to have that thought of what your story is going to be about. So it's worthwhile to trust your instincts, to sit down and write, even if what you write isn't in order that it will be in your book. So
right.
those are really
yes.
important things, I think, for everyone to listen to. We're close to running out of time, but I do want to ask you if you will play Final Five with me. It's 5 quick questions and 5 quick answers.
Okay, I'll try to do them right.
Okay, so I should also tell you it's called Stump the Author. So,
oh,
but
no.
you already agreed,
oh,
so
no.
too bad. Okay, no, it's still all about you, okay?
Okay.
We'll start with something really easy. Right now on your nightstand, whose book is there that you're reading? I know about Frankenstein. That one doesn't count. What are you reading for you?
It is it's Hercule Poirot's Christmas.
Love Hercule Poirot. Do you know the reason I got started on mysteries is because I heard about Agatha Christie's books, and she
yes.
has like 110 books, and so I read
yes.
all of her books in order.
Oh,
and,
I love it.
Because I didn't know if you were supposed to do that or not, but I figured, well, she wrote 110 books, and she has all these great characters in there, and some are series characters like Miss Marple, and some were like Hercule Poirot, obviously. So I read them in order, and I loved them, and that got me started on my my death spiral toward mysteries and thrillers.
What a
and
great
David Morrell,
story.
Yeah. David Morrell got me started on thrillers when I read his Brotherhood of the Rose. I tell him that all the time. Magnificent
Man.
Oh,
I love that book.
I know.
He's
isn't
so
that great?
Good.
Yeah, I do too.
When I first met him,
he's amazing. David is one of the neatest people in the world. He really is. We've seen each other a bunch of times, and he's a regular guest in the show, so I love him. I will tell you a funny story, though. When I went to my first Thriller Fest, I took Brotherhood of the Rose in this ratty paperback that I had purchased to read that book. I had scotch taped the cover back on there. And so John Land, who you know is a thriller writer, saw me, and he knew I wanted to meet Professor Morrell. So he said, Pam, you know, you can go to the book table and you can buy a new copy. And I was horrified. My eyes popped open. My mouth was in an, oh, you must be kidding. I said, oh, I couldn't do that. This is all in front of David Morrell now. And I said, I can't do that. This book is like a Bible to me. This is what introduced me.
It was your gateway drug.
Yeah, it was the book that got me reading spy novels, for crying out loud. So I, my hands were shaking, and he introduced me to David Morrell, and John calls him Professor. I still call him Professor also, because he is a professor of English literature.
Yeah.
He was a teacher for a long time. And so I said, do you mind signing this? And he said, no, I think it's great that you want me to sign your book that's so tattered and so well-read.
Of course
he did. It's been read so many times. Oh, my God. And then he gave me one of his new books in hardcover and signed that, too. So, this is why I love talking to authors. You're my celebrities. You really are. I don't miss not having a TV or anything else. Okay, five quick questions, five quick answers. You answered one. Tell me who your favorite band is. I really want to know about music.
Oh, my favorite band. That's so hard. Oh.
Okay, what kind of music
Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Crosby, Stills, and
Nash. Oh, me too. God, I love that, yeah. Even with
I love
Young,
the harmonies.
Too. And, yes, I know,
okay,
right?
We'll
oh,
take the
God.
Young. That's okay.
So good, yeah. I even like Neil Young listening to his nasally voice all the time, when he sings Southern Man or something. I love
oh,
it, so I get it.
I can bear Southern Man. Yes.
Yeah, so tell me something on your bucket list.
You know, I was just thinking about that today. I want to go to Scotland. I want to walk around Scotland. I have never been.
Oh, my God.
And
so let me know when you're going, okay, because I want to go, too.
I want to go.
And I know lots of writers over there, so absolutely. It's a great bucket list item. The next thing I want to know is tell me one of the names of your children or their first names only, please.
Oh, Cleveland.
Okay. Okay, so Cleveland and I are going to write a book about your life. What are we going to call it?
What are you going to call it?
What's the title going to be?
She wasn't good, but she had good intentions.
Okay, I like it. I like it.
I totally
okay, and here's
it.
Your final
so
question, because this is
okay.
This one is really very telling, okay? So when was the first time when someone asked you what you did that you didn't say writer, but you said author? Or have you ever?
Oh, I don't use that word. I don't.
See,
I just say writer.
Isn't that amazing to me? Yet what do you do? You are an author. Why are writers afraid to say that?
I think because we feel like it sounds pretentious.
I don't think it does. I think it's amazing. When I say
no,
I have friends who are authors.
Because writing is, well, I think the difference is an author is a noun, right? An author is like a person with an image, an author who authors something. But a writer is somebody who practices a craft because we're craft people. And an author doesn't sound like a craft person. A writer, it's our craft.
And see, and I'm looking at it totally opposite. I think I can write like the wind. If I'm doing descriptions, or if I'm doing a tweet, or if I'm setting up, I can write. And it part of the craft of producing in this network is understanding how to develop a show and create programming and all. But I'm certainly not an author. You, however, are author Laura Benedict, who writes suspense novels and mysteries. And I'm grateful for that.
I can see your point. Like, I have an author page, but it feels awkward. Because writer page,
so
I know what you mean. Okay.
It's so funny. No one yet has admitted that they call themselves author. I've had people say, you know, how shall I address you? And they say king or queen or something, or your highness, you know. And I laugh right along with them. I can do that too. You know, Susan Elizabeth Phillips and I talk about it all the time. I call her queen or your highness, your majesty, things
like
that.
Oh, I like that.
But, yeah, I love it. I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. You've made me laugh. You've given me food for thought. So when I read your next book, when will we see a new book from Laura Benedict, author?
When I finish it. I don't know. I'm working on it. And as soon as I can get it done and out there, you will have it. And I'm also working on some short stories that you'll probably see sooner. So I'll let you know.
I will love that.
When they're around.
I will love that. Will you come back one day and maybe interview one of your friends? Come back and take the microphone and be the host?
That would be a blast. That would be
Why
a blast.
Why don't we plan
thank
that,
so
okay?
Much.
I cannot thank you enough for being my guest tonight, Laura. I've had so much fun talking to you. I knew it would be fun. I knew I would learn things, and sure enough, I did. Thank you so much, and good luck with the writing. Although I think you've got talent in spades, so you don't need the luck. It's going to happen automatically.
Well, thank you for making this such a pleasure. It has been so fun, and I love laughing with you. This has been
Thank
fabulous.
You so much. I appreciate that. Have a good night, okay?
Thanks, you too.
And we'll talk soon. All righty, bye-bye.
Okay, great, bye-bye.
Next Friday, or this Friday rather, Elizabeth Heider joins me. Elizabeth writes some killer thrillers. I can't wait for you to hear about her. Thanks so much for being with me tonight, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.